वक्रतुंड महाकाय सूर्यकोटिसमप्रभा निर्विघ्नं कुरु मे देव सर्वकार्येषु सर्वदा शिवशक्त्यायुक्तो यदि भवति शक्तः प्रभवितुम् न चेदेवं देवो न खलु कुशलः स्पन्दितुमपि अथ स्त्वामाराध्या हरिहर विरिञ्चाधिभिरपि प्रणन्तुं स्तोतुं वा कथमकृतपुण्यः प्रभवति
Om Shri Sai Ram, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram from Prashantinilayam. And with me, Team Radio Sai Sunil, welcoming you to Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashantinilayam. Today is the 26th of December 2019, and here in Prashanti, the Christmas celebrations are on. This evening, we have programs in the Sai Kulwant Hall, speeches by guest speakers, followed by a Christmas drama. You can catch the celebrations live on Radio Sai's audio streams and Radio Sai YouTube channel. Let me now read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is it that we can emulate from the great devotee Hanuman? Bhagwan lovingly explains today, and I quote, Hanuman is the brightest example of a realized soul who succeeded in the journey of life. When he first presented himself before Rama and offered his services, Rama turned to Lakshmana and said, Brother, listen. Notice how Hanuman has mastered the Vedas. His speech is saturated with humility and dedication, which the Rig Veda embodies. The retentiveness and reverence that Yajur Veda promotes, and the intuitive vision that Sama Veda grants. Hanuman is a genuine devotee and knows all scriptural texts. Sugriva is fortunate to have Hanuman as his minister, whose thoughts, words and deeds are offered to God. When these three are in perfect harmony, they will surely win God's grace, just as Hanuman succeeded. Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on April 18, 1986. Before I move on to today's program that I've lined up. Today we are also experiencing solar eclipse in most parts of India. Should we fear solar eclipse? What does Swami say? A lot of anxiety spreads every time there is an eclipse. Speaking about the phenomenon on a few occasions, Swami has made it very clear that such fear is pointless. Let us take this opportunity to remind ourselves of what Swami says about eclipses, and I quote, The day after tomorrow, there will be a solar eclipse, and people are filled with apprehensions about the effects of the eclipse on the world. There is no need for fears of any kind because such events occur from time to time. The earth came out of the sun. The moon came from the earth. The moon sometimes comes between the sun and the earth. At those times, the sun cannot be seen. This is the eclipse of the sun. When the sun, the moon and the earth are in one line, it is wrong to think that any disaster will happen to the earth. No dangers are in prospect. Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on October 22, 1995. Let me also read out another quote from Swami. I quote, "The shadow of the moon falling upon the sun is not the calamity that people should fear. The shadow of Maya falling upon the intelligence is the eclipse that has to be treated as a bad omen. The mind is the moon. The intelligence is the sun. See that they do not suffer from eclipse. Then you are safe. Do not worry when something happens in the outer sky. Worry when the shadow of some dark desire, some foul passion, some monstrous emotion, some fell intention casts its evil gloom over your inner sky. See that the splendor of the Lord, the cool rays of His grace, are not dimmed in the recesses of your heart." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on November 23rd, 1965. So dear listeners, Swami has made it clear that we need not fear the eclipse. And today in Divine Glory, I've lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by a tryst with divinity conversation with Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan, who was in news recently. Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan, a devotee of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba and an adjunct faculty at the Department of Mathematics and Computer Science, Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, has been nominated as the next president of the National Science Foundation, United States of America, by President Trump. Dr. S. Panchanathan, or Panch, as he is lovingly called, currently serves as the Executive Vice President and the Chief Research and Innovation Officer at Arizona State University. In conversation with Dr. Panch was Sister Karuna. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to V. Ramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Later at 11:30, Bishu will join you with a segment Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. So please stay tuned. Thank you, and here it is for your listening pleasure.
Chapter 36, Wonderful Stories of the Two Goa Gentlemen, Mrs. Auranga Bhatkar. This chapter relates the wonderful stories of two gentlemen from Goa and Mrs. Auranga Bhatkar of Solapur. Two gentlemen. Once, two gentlemen came from Goa for taking darshan of Sai Baba and prostrated themselves before him. Though both came together, Baba asked only one of them to give him 15 rupees as dakshina, which was paid willingly. The other man voluntarily offered 35 rupees, which was rejected by Baba to the astonishment of all. Shama, who was present, asked Baba, "What is this? Both came together. One's dakshina you accept, the other's, though voluntarily paid, you refuse. Why this distinction?" Baba replied, "Shama, you know nothing. I take nothing from anybody. The Masjid Mai calls for the debt. The donor pays it and becomes free. Have I any home, property or family to look after? I require nothing. I am ever free. Debt, enmity and murder have to be atoned for, as there is no escape from them." Baba then continued in his characteristic way as follows. At first he was poor and took a vow to his God that he would pay his first month's salary if he got a job. He got one for 15 rupees per month. Then he steadily got promotions. From 15 rupees he got 30, 60, 100, 200 and ultimately 700 rupees per month. But in his prosperity, he forgot completely the vow he took. The force of his karma has driven him here, and I ask that amount of 15 rupees from him as dakshina. Another story. While wandering by the seaside, I came to a huge mansion and sat on its veranda. The Brahmin owner gave me a good reception and fed me sumptuously. He showed me a neat and clean place near a cupboard for sleeping. I slept there. While I was sound asleep, the man removed a laterite slab and broke the wall, crept in and scissored off all the money from my pocket. When I woke up, I found that 30,000 rupees were stolen. I was greatly distressed and sat weeping and mourning. The money was in currency notes and I thought that the Brahmin had stolen it. I lost all interest in food and drink and sat for a fortnight on the veranda bemoaning my loss. After the fortnight was over, a passing fakir saw me crying and made inquiries regarding the cause of my sorrow. I told him everything. He said, "If you act according to my bidding, you will recover your money. Go to a fakir, I shall give his whereabouts. Surrender yourself to him, he will get your money back. In the meanwhile, give up your favorite food till you recover your money." I followed the fakir's advice and got my money. Then went to the seashore where a steamer was standing, but I could not get into it as it was overcrowded. There, a good-natured man interceded for me and I got in, luckily. That brought me to another shore, from where I caught a train and came to the Masjid Mai. The story finished, and Baba asked Shama to take the guests and arrange for their feeding. Then Shama took them home and fed them. At dinner, Shama said to the guests that Baba's story was rather mysterious, as he had never gone to the seaside, never had any money, never travelled, never lost any money, and never recovered it, and inquired from them whether they understood it and caught its significance. The guests were deeply moved and were shedding tears. In a choked voice they said that Baba was omniscient, infinite, the Supreme One, without a second. The story he gave out is exactly our story. What he spoke has already taken place in our case. How did he know of this? Is a wonder of wonders. We shall give all the details after the meals. Then, after the meals, while they were chewing betel leaves, the guests began to tell their stories. One of them said, "A hill station on the Ghats is my native place. I went to Goa to earn my living by securing a job. I took a vow to God Datta that if I got any service, I would offer him my first month's salary. By his grace, I got a job of 15 rupees and then I got promotions as described by Baba. I did forget all about my vow. Baba has just reminded me of it in this way and recovered 15 rupees from me. It is not dakshina as one may think of it, but a repayment of an old debt and fulfillment of a long forgotten vow." Moral. In fact, Baba never begged for any money, nor allowed his bhaktas to beg. He regarded money as a danger or bar to spiritual progress and did not allow his bhaktas to fall into its clutches. Bhagat Mahasapati is a case in point. He was very poor and could hardly make both ends meet. Baba never allowed him to make any money nor gave him anything from the dakshina collection. Once, a kind and liberal merchant named Hansraj gave a large amount of money to Mahasapati in Baba's presence, but Baba did not permit him to accept it. Then the second guest began his tale. "My Brahmin cook was serving me faithfully for 35 years. Unfortunately, he fell into bad ways, his mind changed, and he robbed me of my treasure. by removing a laterite slab from my wall where my cupboard is fixed, he came in while we were all deep asleep and carried away all my accumulated wealth, 30,000 rupees in currency notes. I do not know how Baba mentioned the exact amount. I sat crying day and night. My inquiries came to nothing. I spent a fortnight in great anxiety. As I sat on the veranda, sad and dejected, a passing fakir saw my condition and inquired of its cause, and I told him all about it. He told me that an awaliya by name Sai lives in Shirdi, Kopargaon Taluk. Make a vow to him and give up any food that you like best and say to him mentally that I have given up eating that food till I take your darshan. Then I took the vow and gave up eating rice and said, Baba, I'll eat it after recovering my property and after taking your darshan. 15 days passed after this. The Brahmin of his own accord came to me, returned my money and apologized, saying, I went mad and acted thus. I now place my head on your feet. Please forgive me. Thus everything ended well. The fakir that met me and helped me was not seen again. An intensive desire to see Sai Baba, whom the fakir pointed out to me, arose in my mind. I thought the fakir who came all the way to my house was no other than Sai Baba. Would he who saw me and helped me to get my lost money ever covet to get 35 rupees? On the contrary, without expecting anything from us, he always leads us on the path of spiritual progress. I was overjoyed when I recovered my stolen property, and being ignorant, I forgot all about my vow. Then, when I went to Kulaba, one night I saw Sai Baba in my dream. This reminded me of my promised visit to Shirdi. I went to Goa and from there wanted to start for Shirdi by taking a steamer to Mumbai en route. But when I came to the harbour, I found the steamer was crowded and there was no place. The captain did not allow me, but on the intercession of a pune who was a stranger to me, I was allowed to get into the steamer which brought me to Mumbai. From there I came by train. Surely I think that Baba is all-pervading and all-knowing. What are we and where is our home? How fortunate we are that Baba got our money back and drew us here to himself. Shirdi folks must be infinitely superior and more fortunate than we, for Baba has played, laughed, talked and lived with you all for so many years. I think that your store of good merits must be infinite. Sai is our Datta, Lord Dattatreya. He gave me a seat in the steamer and brought me here, and thus gave proof of his omniscience and omnipotence. Mrs. Aurangabadkar. A lady from Sholapur, the wife of Sakharam Aurangabadkar, had no issue during the long period of 27 years. She had made a number of vows to gods and goddesses for an issue, but was not successful. She then became almost hopeless. To make a last attempt in this matter, she came to Shirdi with her stepson Vishwanath and stayed there for 2 months serving Baba. Whenever she went to the masjid, she found Baba surrounded by devotees. She wanted to see Baba alone, fall at his feet and open her heart and pray for an issue. But she did not get any suitable opportunity. Ultimately, she requested Shama to intercede with Baba for her when he was alone. Shama said to her that Baba's darbar was open. Still, he would try for her and that the Lord might bless her. He asked her to sit ready with a coconut and joss sticks in the open courtyard at the time of Baba's meals and that when he beckoned to her, she should come up. One day, after dinner, when Shama was wiping Baba's wet hands with a towel, the latter pinched Shama's cheek. Shama, feigning anger, said, Deva, is it proper for you to pinch me like this? We don't want such a mischievous god who pinches us like this. Are we your dependents? Is this the fruit of our intimacy? Baba replied, O Shama, during the 72 generations that you were with me, I never pinched you till now. And now you resent my touching you? Shama replied, I want a god who will always love us and give us new dishes to eat. We do not want any reward from you or heaven. Let our faith unto your feet be ever awake. Baba said, Yes, I have indeed come for that. I have been feeding and nursing you, and have got great love and affection for you. Then Baba went up and took his seat. Shama beckoned to the lady. She came up, bowed down, and presented the coconut and jaw sticks. Baba shook the coconut, which was dry. The kernel within rolled and made a noise. Baba said, Shama, this is rolling. See what it says? Shama. The woman prays that a child should similarly roll in her womb. So please give her the coconut with your blessing. Baba said, Will the coconut give her any issue? How foolish people are to fancy such things. Shama said, I know the power of your words and blessing. Your word will give her a series of children. You're wrangling and not giving real blessing. The parley went on for a while. Baba repeatedly ordered to break the coconut, and Shama pleaded for the gift of the entire fruit to the lady. Finally, Baba yielded and said, She will have an issue. Shama asked, When? Baba said, In 12 months. At this, the coconut was broken into two parts. One was eaten by the two, the other was given to the lady. Then Shama turned up to the lady and said, Dear lady, you are a witness to my words. If within 12 months you do not get a child, I will break a coconut against this deva's head and drive him out of this masjid. If I fail in this, I will not call myself Madhav. You will soon realize what I say. The lady delivered a son in a year's time, and the son was brought to Baba in his 5th month. The couple, both husband and wife, prostrated before Baba, and the grateful father paid a sum of 500 rupees which was spent in constructing a shed for Baba's horse, Shyam Karna. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 37 Chavadi Procession. In this chapter, Hemad Pant, after making some preliminary observations on some points of Vedanta, describes the Chavadi Procession. Preliminary. Blessed is Sai's life for his devotees. Blessed is his daily routine. His ways and actions are indescribable. Sometimes he was intoxicated with Brahmanand, divine bliss, and at other times completely self-absorbed. While doing so many things at the same time, he was yet unconcerned with them. Though he seemed at times quite inactive, he was not idle or dozing. He always abided in his own self. Though he looked calm and placid as a sea, he was deep and unfathomable. Who can describe his ineffable nature? He regarded men as brothers, women as sisters and mothers. He was a perfect celibate, as everybody knows. May the knowledge we got in his company last long unto death. Let us ever serve him with wholehearted devotion to his feet. Let us see him in all beings, and let us constantly remember his name. Hemad Pant, after making some lengthy dissertations on some topics of Vedanta, which he himself considers as a digression, goes on to describe the Chavadi Procession. Chavadi Procession. Baba's dormitory has already been described. One day he slept in the masjid, and on the next in the Chavadi near the masjid. He slept in the masjid and in the Chavadi in alternate days. This alternate sleeping at both these places went on till Baba's Mahasamadhi. From 10th December 1909, devotees began to offer regular worship to Baba in the Chavadi. This we will now describe with his grace. When the day of retiring to the Chavadi came, people flocked to the masjid and did bhajan in the mandap for a few hours. Behind them was a beautiful palanquin, to the right a tulsi vrindavan, and in front Baba adorned his seat, and there were devotees singing bhajans. Men and women who had a liking for the bhajan came in time. Some took tal, chiplis and kartal, mridang, kanjiri and ghol, all in the hands and conducted the bhajan. Sai Baba was the magnet. He drew all the devotees to him. Outside in the open, some trimmed the divatyas, some decorated the palanquin, and some stood with cane sticks in their hands and hailed victory to Baba. The corners were decorated with buntings. In the masjid, rows of burning oil lamps shed their light. Baba's horse, Shyamkarna, stood fully decorated outside. Then, Tatya Patil came with a group of men to Baba and asked him to be ready. Baba sat quiet in his place till Tatya came and helped him get up by putting his arm under Baba's arm. Tatya called Baba by the name of Mama or maternal uncle. Really, their relationship was extremely intimate. Baba wore on his body the usual kafni, took his satka under his armpit, and after taking his chilim and tobacco and placing a cloth over his shoulder, became ready to start. Then Tatya placed a golden embroidered beautiful shela or shawl over his body. After this, Baba himself put a few fuel sticks in the dhuni to keep it alive and with his right hand extinguished the lamp burning near the dhuni and then started for the chavadi. Then all sorts of musical instruments, band and horns gave out different sounds and the fireworks exhibited various colored views. Men and women, singing Baba's name, started walking, doing bhajan to the accompaniment of mridang and veena. Some danced with joy and some carried various flags. The bhaldars announced Baba's name when he came on the steps of the masjid. On the two sides of Baba stood persons who held chamar and others who fanned Baba. On the way were spread folds of cloth which Baba walked on, being supported by devotees' hands. Tatya Patil held the left hand and Mahal Sapati the right, and Bapu Sahib Jog held the chhatra or the umbrella over his head. In this fashion Baba marched on to the chavadi. The fully decorated horse named Shyamkarna led the way, and behind him were all the carriers, waiters, musical players and the crowd of devotees. Harinam, the name of Lord, was being chanted to the accompaniment of music as also the name of Sai. In this manner, the procession reached the corner and everyone joined the party, seemed pleased and delighted. On reaching this corner, Baba stood facing the chavadi and shone with a peculiar aura. It seemed as if the face of Baba took over the glory of the rising sun. Baba stood there with a concentrated mind, facing the north, as if he was signaling something. All the instruments played music while Baba moved his right hand up and down for some time. Kaka Sahib Dikshit at this time came forward with a silver plate containing flowers smeared with gulal and threw them on Baba's body off and on. The musical instruments played the best at this juncture and Baba's face beamed with radiance and beauty, and all the persons viewed this luster to their heart's content. Words fail to describe the splendor of the scene. Sometimes Mahasapati began to dance as if possessed by some deity, but all were surprised to see that Baba's concentration was least disturbed. With a lantern in his hand, Tatya Patil walked on Baba's left side and Bhagat Mahasapati on the right, holding in his hand the hem of Baba's garment. What a beautiful procession and what an expression of devotion. To witness this, men and women, poor and rich, flocked there. Baba walked at a very slow pace. Bhaktas followed on both sides with love and devotion. With joy permeating the whole atmosphere of the place, the procession reached the chavadi. Those days are gone now. Nobody can see them in the future. But by remembering and visualizing that sight, we can bring solace and ecstasy to our minds. The chavadi was also fully decorated with a good white ceiling mirrors and many sorts of lamps. On reaching there, Tatya went ahead and spread an asan and placing a bolster, made Baba sit there and made him wear angharka. Then the devotees worshipped him in various ways. They put a crown on his head with a tuft of bark, placed garlands of flowers and jewels around his neck, and marking his forehead with musk mixed vertical lines, they gazed at him for long to their heart's content. They changed his headdress now and then, held it aloft on the head, fearing that Baba might throw it away. Baba knew what the bhaktas wished for and meekly submitted to all their ways without objection. With these adornments, he looked wonderful and beautiful. Nana Sahib Nemonkar held the chhatra with its beautiful pendants which moved in a circle with its supporting stick. Bapu Sahib Jog washed his feet in a silver dish, offered argya and worship with due formalities, then smeared his arms with chandan paste and offered him tambul. Baba sat on the asan while Tathya and others kept standing. When Baba sat on the gaddi, supporting himself against the bolster, devotees on both sides waved chamars and fans. Shama then prepared the chillum and handed it over to Tathya Patil, who drew a flame out of it by inhaling a deep breath through his mouth and then gave it to Baba. After Baba had a smoke, it was given to Bhagat Mahasapati and then it was passed round to all. Blessed was the inanimate chillum. It had first to undergo many ordeals of penance, such as being kneaded by potmakers, dried in the sun and burnt in the fire. And then it had the good fortune to get the contact of Baba's hand and his kiss. After this function was over, devotees put garlands of flowers around his neck and gave him scent and bunches of flowers. Baba, who was an incarnation of dispassion, cared a fig for all these necklaces of jewels and garlands of flowers and other decorations. But out of real love to his devotees, he allowed them to have their own way and to please themselves. Finally, Bapu Sahib Jog waved the arati over Baba, observing all formalities, and the musical instruments played their auspicious tunes. When this arati was over, the devotees returned home, one by one saluting Baba and taking his leave. When Tathya Patil, after offering chillum, attar and rose water, stood to depart, Baba said to him lovingly, "Guard me properly. Go if you like, but return sometimes at night and inquire for me." On replying in the affirmative, Tathya Patil left the chavadi and went home. Then Baba himself prepared his bed. He arranged some sheets one upon another, and thus making his bed, went to rest. We shall also now take rest and close this chapter with a request to the readers that they should remember Baba and his chavadi procession daily before they retire and go to bed. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Guru Var ki Paramanand Sadara. Mr. Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Dear listeners, Sai Ram, welcome to our radio program, Tryst with Divinity, a series of conversations with individuals whose lives have been touched and transformed by the love of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Our guest today is Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan. In conversation with him is Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi, and this interview was recorded on 31st December 2016. Have a listen, please.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity. I'm deeply honored to be sitting across from Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan, PhD. He is the Executive Vice President and the Chief Research and Innovation Officer at the Arizona State University. And he does many more important things. Just by way of introduction, if I can bring you up to speed, a Dr. Panchanathan, who is fondly known as Dr. Panch, has completed his electronics and communication engineering from the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. He went on to get his M.Tech in electrical engineering from IIT Madras and a PhD in computer engineering from the University of Ottawa in Canada. Currently, apart from playing this very leading role at the Arizona State University, he also happens to be one of the hand-picked 25 persons who are appointed by the President to the National Science Board in the United States of America. And by President, I mean the President of the United States. In his case, it was President Obama who picked him amongst the distinguished 25 people in the entire country. And the role of the National Science Board is to advise the President of the United States of America and the American Congress on science policy and to oversee the National Science Foundation. In this area, Dr. Panch is the chair of the Committee for Strategy and Budget, which sets the science priorities for the nation with a whopping annual budget of $7.4 billion. And at the Arizona State University also, Dr. Panch has played a critical role in bringing up the ranking of the university. Today, it is recognized as the largest university with 100,000 students and 3,000 faculty members, and it has been designated as the most innovative university second year in a row, followed by Stanford and MIT. And as though his hands are not full enough, from the bottom of his heart, he serves his Sadhguru Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba as the regional president of the Satya Sai Organization for Region 9 in the United States, and Region 9 includes the states of Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. On that note, I welcome Dr. Panch to Radio Sai. Sairam, sir, and a very warm welcome.
Jai Sairam, and thank you for having me here. It is truly a pleasure to be here, because whenever I come to Puttaparthi, it is like coming home.
Truly.
And so it is truly a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you today.
And it's an honor for us to have such a distinguished guest amongst us. And I'm sure our listeners will benefit so much from hearing from you, because the brief conversation I had over the last 10-15 minutes, I have learned so much. So, Dr. Panch, whatever you do with such a passion. And you're clearly such a high achiever. What role does Satya Sai Baba have in your success?
Everything. He is the inner motivator. He is the doer. He is everything to me, because he has been the inspiration for all the things that I do day in and day out. So all through my life, he has been the seen and the unseen hand that has moved everything. One time Swami told me, I am in you, I am with you, I am around you. So I take it as Swami is always with me, and he is the one that is guiding me. So any action that I do, any talk that I give, any meeting that I go to, I will close my eyes and I will picture that Swami is inside my frame. And I will say, Swami, please not let this body become an impediment for you to do your action through this body today or this instrument today. So I hope that I will serve as his worthy instrument all my life. And that's my humble prayer to Bhagawan all the time.
I believe you had asked him specifically how you wanted your body to be used. Tell us about that.
So one time I was in an interview room with Swami, and I pointed to my heart here, and I pulled my shirt up and I said, Swami, how do you want this body to serve you? And Swami immediately looked at me intently and said, work is worship, duty is God, do your duty. And since then, you know, since that instruction, it's become very clear that he is working through me, because I can tell you that all the things that you read, sometimes I look at that and I say to myself, it cannot be me that does any of that, because it cannot happen if it was just me. It has to be Swami that is working through us. And that is why we are able to do things that we can't even recognize that we can do in our physical frame, as we often think about what our limitations are, what our constraints are, and so on. But he unleashes us from all of that and actually truly works through us. And the only prayer that we should have every morning, in my humble opinion, is to allow him to work through us and not become an impediment for him to work through us. And so that's, I think, should be the prayer that we have to Swami. And I have to say that is what keeps me moving forward and doing the things that you alluded to in my professional life as well as in my personal life. And there's no difference, basically, because when Swami says work is worship, work means all kinds of work. It doesn't matter whether it's cleaning the bathroom to whether it is actually, you know, serving in the National Science Board. For me, all of that is work. And if Swami is doing every one of it, then why draw a distinction between this and that?
Hmm. You speak of such deep humility. My question to you is, you have a stellar resume. You are a man of a great professional and academic achievement. Why do you say that you have to make sure you're not an impediment to the flow of God's will through you?
Oftentimes, you know, as Swami says, our ego can come along the way and make us do things that are not following the human values. Swami wants us to express the human values every moment of our life. So I find that the moment we let us take over, then I feel, at least, this is just my humble opinion again, I feel that we are not allowing those human values to express itself through us in its fullest form. And that's what I mean by saying that, you know, we have to make sure that we should let Swami work through us and be a true instrument and let his inspiration guide us.
Dr. Pant, you play such a critical role as part of the National Science Board, where you advise President Obama. And you still have 4 more years of that term, so you're likely to even advise President Trump going forward. Select 25 people. You're part of that cream of people who decide what shape or direction science will take in the United States, and, you know, the whopping budget of $7.4 billion. What is it like to be you and sit there across from President Obama?
So I think it is, again, we are all doing what we are supposed to do, our roles. You know, when we talk about, you know, when Swami's given me a role, it is just a role. And, you know, one time I remember I was sitting in the Purnachandra auditorium, and Swami was talking to the faculty and students. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that, you know, we are all actors in a play. And he said, you are all actors in a play. I am the director of the play. I am also an actor, but I am a good actor, he said. You know, so when you take that seriously, then what it is that we are all playing our roles. Each one of the member of the National Science Board is really working hard to ensure that the country is globally competitive. The country is in the leading edge of scientific exploration. So when you look at it that way, every input then becomes an important part of the whole. So we are not just, you know, us doing it versus somebody else, but we are us doing it with everyone else. And so it doesn't matter whether it is the president or a senator or a congressman or a National Science Board member. It doesn't matter who it is. We are all trying to do our roles to the best of our ability. To achieve one purpose is to make the nation and the globe a much better place than it would be otherwise.
But can't science be used against the well-being, welfare of humanity, especially through military use that the United States of America is well known for?
Yeah, you could say that, you know, science can also have, you know, the impacts, the so-called negative impacts. Mm-hmm. But most scientific discoveries that are used for human well-being came about because of the war times, the World War I, World War II, resulted in many different scientific discoveries and inventions that has then benefited humanity in so many other ways. So these becomes then a mechanism by which new science explorations and new scientific discoveries and inventions happen. So sometimes we only focus on the negative side of it, but most of the time a lot more positives happen instead of the negatives. And therefore we should be grateful for the fact that all of this helps us to advance the scientific thought, the scientific experience, and scientific progress. And I think that is a very, very important thing to remember and not get trapped in that science can also be used for that. Anything, for example, can be used for both positive and negative. And you always try to see how you can channel it for positive outcomes.
And being a person who believes in the five human values and you're committed to them, how do you bring that mindset into the discussions of the Science Foundation that you lead?
When you think about human progress, you know, whatever scientific explorations that we are engaged in is because it's about human progress. It's about mankind and human progress. And therefore, it is either extraterrestrial exploration or whether it's explorations inside the human body. It doesn't matter whether it is, you know, the micro level of explorations that happens inside the body at the nanoscale or even smaller scales, to all the way up to the mega scales when you're exploring the outer universe. All of that is for betterment of humankind. And therefore, for me, it is just that thought that what I will do in a small way, in a very humble way, is to contribute to the well-being of the humankind, understanding of the humankind, and contributing to the well-being of the humankind. And I think I feel very grateful that Swami has given me this opportunity to be able to do that.
It's up to you if you want to answer it or not, but Dr. Panch, in your considered opinion, is there extraterrestrial life?
I think there's enough to talk about in the life inside our planet. There's so much to be done here. So, therefore, I don't focus much on whether there's extraterrestrial life or not.
Classified information. Is that so? Nice diplomatic answer, but I respect your need to be careful on that account. Now, I understand that you really played a huge role in bringing up the level of learning and the ranking of the Arizona State University through infusing human values into the curriculum, into the climate of the university campus. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah. When Swami says you have given a role and he wants us to be absolutely excellent in our role. So excellence, what is excellence?
Yes.
You know, they actually define excellence. To me, excellence is, are you expressing the human values to the fullest extent? If you did, then you are excellent. You have to be excellent because you're essentially allowing Swami to work through you, the instrument, in expressing that excellence, right? Through the human values, through practicing the human values. So for me, therefore, these are not two different things. You know, oftentimes there is this feeling that somehow if you're a spiritual person, then you cannot be living in the world and accomplishing things. I don't think these are two different things at all. They're all one and the same. There are no two different personalities. There's only one personality, that is you. And if you let Swami work through you, then you will achieve excellence because Swami will, you know, if you look at Swami's life, that is the most excellent example. He is the best exemplar that we ask for. Every day of his life, he worked so hard and strived for excellence in everything that he did in the human form. And, you know, he was not just, you know, I am God and therefore I'm just going to sit and, you know,
Let things happen because I willed it,
right? Instead, he did his part having taken the human form. And therefore, it behooves us to be exactly the same. Not any different, that we have been given a human form, and if we truly believe that Swami is working through us, then just do the things and express the human value so that you can be excellent in everything that you do. And I tell you, when you take this approach, I'm not saying this because I do this all the time. I have my share of my own, you know, negative energies sometimes. But I can tell you, whenever the positivity is expressed, the outcomes are way beyond what you would think it will be.
Help me understand how.
Yeah, let me give you an example.
Please.
So, a few years ago, you know, I was sitting in Prashantinilayam here and in front of Bhagwan, and there was a question was asked, Swami, there is a workshop on information to transformation, right? So, Swami immediately responded by saying, what information, what transformation? Information is only in formation.
In the process of formation.
Exactly.
Okay.
He broke the word information as in formation.
Right.
There is only transformation of information, but there is no real transformation.
Wow.
So this is what he said. In almost instantaneous response, I was sort of taken aback by that, being a professor of computer science and engineering and working in the area of information. It seemed very profound to me because we always try to understand what information is. We still are trying to understand what information is. So truly then information is information, right? Then there's only transformation of information, which means that if you encapsulate all the things that happens in computer science and information technology or whatever, you can encapsulate it in this one form, that information is all about transforming from one form to another form.
Like you said, bits to bytes to...
Bits to bytes, bytes to video, this conversation that we're having, or images, or whatever that might be that we do. You store data in a database, or you compress data, and then you decompress the data. All of this is transforming from one form to the other, basically. And then last is, but there is no real transformation, is what he said. So I said to myself, boy, What does Swami really mean by real transformation? Mm-hmm. How can information lead to real transformation? And this was the question that I had. And as I was flying back to the United States that trip, I was constantly saying, Swami, can you please expound to me? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by saying information should result in real transformation? Believe it or not, as soon as I landed in the United States at that time, there came an opportunity for a big project from the Natural Science Foundation called the Information Technology Research Program. And this was focused on how can information technology be applied for applications, including human advancement. So I said, wow, this is very coincidental. And there are no coincidences, as you know. And then I assembled a group of people. I'm just going to make it brief because you said there'll be many parts to this. I have to walk you through the entire story of this project in one of the future conversations. So, but in this, I just talk about the magnificence, because you asked me, how does it express in a form that is bigger than what you can ever imagine? And so I'm going to illustrate that by just one example. That's sure. All. So then it happened that, you know, I go there, I assembled a group of people
at the university.
And I started having a discussion about what can we do by bringing all our collective interest in information technology and computer science that can affect and impact humanity. So that was a discussion. As we were having this discussion, we said, oh, maybe we should try to apply information technology for improving health or education, better educational opportunities and so on. Suddenly, one of my colleagues sitting in the room said, how about working for individuals who are blind and visually impaired? The moment he said that, it was like Swami had said, this is what you need to do. And I said, wow, this is so perfect. It was just, I could not have asked for any better. The reason is, I have been working in the area of image processing and computer vision as my research areas for many, many years. And I've only processed images for people who can see images, perceive images. I've never thought of image processing for people who cannot see images. It seemed almost antithetical, but it seemed almost right. It was a very interesting set of responses in my head. I didn't know what to do. I honestly didn't know what to do. So here's what I did. I went to the web, even in those days, this is about 15 years ago. I went to the web and I typed the following words, Arizona and blind. And I said, let me see what comes up as guidance, right? And the first website that came on top of that search was Arizona Schools for the Deaf and Blind. And so I immediately clicked that website. I had two contact numbers. One was Earlene Dykes and another was Cindy Robinson, two people. So I called the first person, message machine, I left a message, trying to explain to them what I was trying to do and seek their guidance to understand what the problem is all about before I embark on solving a problem. The second was Cindy Robinson. I called her up and then I left a message for her too. The next day, interestingly, Cindy Robinson calls me back. Now, I'm having this conversation with Cindy, trying to communicate to her that I'm trying to work on this project of applying computer science to help individuals who are blind and visually impaired. So I'm articulating this to her. And I could see a sense of skepticism in her voice on the other end. But she's not sure, is this guy real? Or is he trying to just get some funding by using the individuals who are blind and visually impaired as an example or as a case study? What is he really trying to do? So she was not very clear. So I could see the skepticism in her voice. So I'm trying to convince her about this, and without talking much about my personal life, because I wanted to not, you know, talk about, you know, I do this in my personal life. I just didn't want to say anything. But finally I said, I have to tell her something that communicates to her that this is coming from really an intention that is pure. So I said, Cindy, in my personal life, I go to the homeless shelter on the weekends, and we do breakfast service for people who are in the homeless shelter. And so we do the service project. This is all I said. Okay? This is all I said. Nothing more. She turned around and she asked me, are you a Sai Baba devotee?
Whoa.
And that moment I knew that Swami wanted me to do this project. I said, Cindy, how did you ask this question? How can you ask this? Because there are 6 billion, 7 billion people on planet Earth. I randomly went to a website. And I pick up this person and I call two people and one person returns my call. And all I have said so far is that I do a service project in downtown homeless shelter. And she says, are you a Sai Baba devotee? And I said, how did you ask me this question? She said, well, Panch, you said service and Sai Baba came to my mind. And so for all of us, Swami is father, mother, friend, guide, philosopher, God. We have so many terms for Swami and how we relate to him. But the public, the people there relate to Swami as synonymous with service. I was taken aback, and then I learned that she had seen Swami in her very young years when she was in Michigan, when she had come to Whitefield and seen Swami. Now you tell me, is this a coincidence? Right? And then I didn't have to explain anything to Cindy because she was so welcoming and wanting to talk to me about what I could do to help the children and the young adults and adults who are blind and visually impaired, and how we might design devices and technologies to be assisting them, right? And that project then took sort of completely a life of its own, you know. When I came the following trip to Swami, I had written a proposal, and Swami called me in for an interview with a group of young adults, and I presented this to Swami, and I said, Swami, I want you to bless this project, Swami. So he opened the project book. It was several pages thick. So he has opened the project book, and I was sitting beside him, and I was trying to tell him to focus on a particular thing, and he said, shh, shh. So he was just flipping through the pages. And then at one point, you know, he knew that I was trying to point to him the system diagram that I had built. Mm. So he came to that and he said, this is what you want to talk about? I said, yes, Swami. He explained to me what I was doing.
Wow.
And he said, this is what you're trying to do, right? I said, yes, Swami. And then he said, Swami, I need your blessings. I need your help, Swami.
Tell us a little bit more about the explanation he gave.
So he basically said, you know, you're trying to take this to the camera, because I had the pictures of people the camera. And then he said, it is coming through the ears, he said. Uh-huh. You know, I was trying to convert it to sound, and then I was trying to listen through the audio. Uh-huh. So he was telling me, this is what you're trying to do, right? Listening to the audio.
So the whole process, the flow diagram.
So I said, yes, Swami. I said, Swami, I need your blessings, Swami. I need your help, Swami. Then he closed the proposal, and he put his hand on top of the proposal, and he said, I will help, I will help, I will help, 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, since that day, I have not been devoid of great ideas that comes to the project. I have not been devoid of people who bring the great ideas who come to the project. I have not been devoid of any resources, any money or anything for the project to continue. Everything comes to the project. I don't go seeking for anything. They come to the project.
Mm-hmm.
So when Swami says, I will help, I will help, I will help, it's at a completely different level of what happens. So here is an example. You asked me, you know, when you say that things are way beyond what you'd have thought, here is a simple thing of information to transformation. I asked a very simple, humble prayer to Swami. Swami, can you please explain to me what you mean by transformation? Then this project unfolds, and there are many, many things, and I will talk to you in a different time in terms of what the project really accomplished. But what the ultimate resulted was not that I did something for the individuals who are blind and visually impaired. If I did not do it, somebody else would have done it. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be Panch who did that. But what that gave me as an opportunity is the following. When I look at the people who are blind and visually impaired, when I see them so excited, so committed, so hardworking, and realizing the opportunities that they have for them, and then I sit and look at myself in the morning complaining about the fact that my alarm didn't go on at the time that I set it, or that my microwave did not heat the food fast enough, breakfast fast enough, or somebody cut me on the highway as I was driving, and I complain about everything that I should not be complaining about. Mm-hmm. And here are these people who can complain all day long. They have the right to complain. But yet they don't complain. But instead they make their life into something beyond what you can ever imagine. Right? So what I learned from this is a small thing. If you really pray to Swami sincerely and say, Swami, I want to be the instrument to do something for humanity, he unfolds that prayer into something which is unimaginable. I would have never thought that the kinds of things that I have done through this project, I would have never imagined doing it. This is not about just applying some computer science for solving problems for humanity. In fact, the problems that I have tackled right now have enriched computer science to a different level that I would have never been able to do.
Can you help us understand?
Yeah. So let me give you an example.
Please.
So in vision, you always process information and you present the information back for with people with vision, right? Mm. Visual information.
Mm.
But if you don't have sight, right? How do you present the information to them? You can present it in audio, as I was saying to you. Right? And that's what I would have normally thought. Mm. But it turned out that when I was talking to people in focus groups and asking them how to present the information, they told me, Panch, but if you start putting stuff in our ears, you're actually blindfolding a sighted person. That's what you're doing.
You're blindfolding a sighted person.
Right?
Okay.
Imagine a sighted person, you blindfold them. You're not doing them any good.
Okay.
Right? Likewise, by putting stuff in our ears, because that is our way in which we understand our environment.
Right.
Through the sounds that come, the Doppler effect, that's how I understand my environment. Mm. So if you start putting stuff inside my ears, thinking that you're helping me by giving information, right? The process information, text or audio cues or whatever that is, you are not helping me, because you're actually obstructing what I would normally get by imposing something on top of it.
Mm.
So then I said, okay, how do you now communicate things to them aside of through sound?
Mm.
So then it opened up a new dimension of touch. Touch-based information, right? So now, haptics, as it is called.
Haptics.
Hapticos is a Greek term which means touch.
Touch.
Right? Tactile sensation. Right? So my whole work now, there's a whole body of work that I have done in the last 15 years on touch interfaces. How do you communicate information through touch?
But isn't Braille also touch-based?
Braille is also touch.
Yeah.
But Braille is where you actively now go and understand what is being communicated to you.
Right.
But imagine that I have a glove.
Yeah.
Okay, or imagine I have a patch on my back.
Okay.
Where I'm able to communicate the information, you know, without people even knowing that it is being communicated in a sort of, you know, passive way, not an active exploratory way, like Braille. I'm getting this information. I have different devices that you can put on your body through which you can communicate tactile cues. Let me give you an example.
Please.
In the very first iteration, we designed the belt.
Okay.
Like you wear a belt. In the belt, there are these small motors like you have in your cell phones, right?
Right.
The vibratory motors. You have vibratory motors around your belt.
Okay.
Okay. So let us say that I'm looking at you.
Yeah.
My camera recognizes that Karuna Munshi is in front of me. Right. And then it communicates to me and says, it recognizes and says, Karuna Munshi is in front of you. Okay. Then you are in front of me. And then it says you're looking at, because I don't want to have a conversation unless you're looking at me.
Yeah.
Because it can be very embarrassing.
Yes, a lot of people who are visually impaired say that that's a challenge, right?
Correct, right? Uh-huh. Because they start talking, thinking that they are looking at them, but they're looking at somebody else, right? Then what happens even worse is you start moving to the right. And I do not know that you have moved to the
right.
But
you're still looking in my previous direction and talking.
But in my belt, my vibrator now
moves
and then it starts to vibrate here, saying that Karuna is now here.
Yeah.
So I can now move
30 degrees to the right.
Yeah, 30 degrees to the right. I can turn where my intuitively where my vibrator tactile information is giving me the data, and I can turn and look at you there, and I can talk to you.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's a natural way of communicating situational awareness, right? And if Colonel, you're walking towards me, the vibrator can vibrate faster,
so you know I'm approaching.
You're approaching me, or you're receding away from me, right? So all of these cues can be given through these vibrotactile motors in a haptical way. Now, you imagine, you're not interfering with their audio abilities, but you're augmenting their perceptions by giving information through another channel, which is not utilized as much. Now, haptics is starting to become mainstream. So although we started working for individuals who are blind in understanding how do we communicate information, but blindness is not a disability, blindness is a concept. I am blind right now. I have no idea what is going on 180 degrees
behind your
back.
Head,
So if I can have augmented perception, knowing what is happening, for example, a soldier in the battlefield, let us say there is a danger coming from the back,
behind,
and if I'm able to say from the belt in the back,
my God,
watch out, there is something coming in your back, that soldier is now augmented with new perception that they didn't have before, and they can be safe, right? Or if you're driving a car, and you have on your seat the vibrotactile information that is telling you, beware, your blind spot, there's a car that is coming, then you're paying attention to that because your visual field now is locked in the front.
It's increased, but this helps you to have an increased visual field.
Correct. So blindness, therefore, is not a disability. It's a concept. We all are blind.
We're all impaired in some way or the other.
Correct. And we get more and more impaired as you age. That is what I'm starting to recognize right now. You know, I leave my glasses at home in the morning and then I'm searching for it as I'm leaving home. And then if only there was a device that was telling me, by the way, you left it in the bathroom when you're washing your face, I could be on meetings on time many, many more times than I am right now. Because I start searching and I become late, I get late to going to meetings, isn't it? So what happens is, that's what happens when you work with individuals who are blind and visually impaired or with other disabilities, it then affects, it impacts the entire population in addition to individuals who are blind and visually impaired.
Actually, I have spent several years with a very dear friend who's visually impaired. She's my senior from Anantapur College. Her name is Rama Devi. And she was my roommate as well. So I'm somewhat familiar with the challenges that she faced and how she overcame them. How can one communicate color to a person who's visually impaired?
Yes, that's beautiful. I'm glad you asked this because Swami made you ask this. Because I had an individual who's blind who worked in my lab. She was an undergraduate in psychology. Laura Bratton is her name. And so Laura came to me one day and said, Panch, I want to engage in your lab as an undergraduate student researcher. I said, absolutely. That's the other beautiful thing. What Swami did was just mind-boggling. As I said, it's just a story in itself. The people coming to the project, right? So Laura came to the project. And I said, Laura, what do you want? What would you like to work on, Laura? She said, Panch, you know, I became blind only recently when I was, you know, a teenager. So I had an understanding of what colors were. And I missed the color information. Right? So I would like to really work on a project that can help communicate color information to me. So what we did was we worked on a project where the camera will pick up the color and we will then transfer it into a form, the red, green, blue form, right, basics, and that we will communicate that information tactily to them. So the assimilation of the combination of red, green and blue gave them a sense of what the color is, that this is yellow, this is magenta, this is green. All of that information comes because of the intensity of the vibration on the three different vibrotactile motors. And so by synthesizing all of them, you say, Punch, this looks awfully complex. How can you communicate color by asking people to integrate stuff? It's amazing that when you have individuals who are blind and visually impaired, their perception is really augmented perception. Since you have lived with a person who's visually impaired, you know that they have a higher level of perception for the environment.
Very, very sensitive.
They can hear, they can hear your footsteps and know who the person is.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So like that, the integration of this information that is presented to them and being able to convert it into a color signal and being able to understand basic color spectrum. We did experiments with Laura on this. And that's how we were able to communicate color information, basic color information. Laura designed the project.
But Laura has a point of reference because she has seen color before.
Correct.
What about somebody who's born visually impaired and does not know that if they go into a park, they're surrounded by flowers and greenery of varying shades?
Correct. That's a very good question. So what we did was, for a person who has no idea that banana is yellow and the sun as it is setting is yellow, let us say, right? So what you do is, for them, color becomes a concept. That is, they will be able to bin the idea of the sun being yellow as it sets and the banana being yellow as a concept that they cluster together, right? So it may not be color as a perception, like in the case of Laura, she'll be able to go and recall the yellow that she had seen and be able to attach it to that. But here, they may not attach it to the color, but they will be able to attach it to a space that brings all of this together. That's what we do, isn't it?
When and that's what Immanuel Kant described knowledge as bins.
Yes, as bins.
Kantian philosophy.
Correct, exactly. It's knowledge after all. See,
categories.
As human beings, we're constantly categorizing.
Yes.
Right? That's what we do. We are pattern recognition machines, constantly classifying and categorizing information, right? So that's what you do, is you take this information and you categorize them. And this is just scratching the surface in the project.
No pun intended with that.
Okay? So, it's just amazing. So, what Swami did, by a small thing that he shared in, I don't want to use the word flippant, but that's how it seemed like, right? Because he casually, immediately said, in no thought, nothing. Just like that he said. And that is so
information.
Powerful. So powerful. That's why I tell people when I give talks in Sai centers, I tell them, every word of Swami is so significant. Every action of Swami is so significant. You know, it is just unbelievably significant, because if you take this small collection and then you see as an example of how it unfolded.
I guess your perception, your sensitivity to value that word so deeply is what led to many of us have heard Swami's words repeatedly.
Yes.
And we almost become immune to the depth of what he's saying, the profundity and the enormity.
Correct.
Because we are very casual about it, my God.
In one of the talks in the future, I will share with you, help ever hurt never, right? We have heard this Swami say so many times. And in my talks that I gave, I talk about, you know, what that really means, what the emphasis is. So we all take pride in the fact we say, help ever hurt never. Thought for the day, when somebody has forgotten to bring the thought for the day, somebody will get up and say, help ever hurt never. Yeah. That is Swami's thought for the day, right?
We parrot it.
Yeah, parrot it, right? So, but Swami is not talking about help or not hurting. And so we take pride. Oh, that day I walked down, I saw the ant. Oh, you know, I didn't step on the ant. I just jumped over it because Swami would not want me to step on the ant. So I did not hurt. So I take pride. I lift my collar up and I say, wow, I followed Swami's teaching. Or help, you know, somebody was just there and the luggage was, you know, in the conveyor belt. I was in the airport and this old lady was not able to lift it. So I helped them lift the luggage. I helped today. So I did follow Swami's message. Nothing wrong in having the pride that you followed Swami's message. But Swami was not talking about that. Swami's emphasis was on ever and never. So when you start to actually pay attention to ever and never, unbelievable what all we have to do in order to actually follow ever and never. Not just help and not hurt, but ever and never.
Wow. This is very interesting. And I know that you are a very busy person, but I just can't let you go without telling us, how did you make such a huge transformation at the Arizona State University and its ranking by bringing in this passion that you carry from Prashanthi Nilayam? Very few people will know that you, perhaps they do know your background, but few will realize that the passion that you bring to everything you do has its source in Prashanthi Nilayam.
Yes.
And your spiritual master.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. In fact, I don't necessarily, you know, sometimes people feel, oh, that thing, you should not bring it to work. I don't. I mean, I don't publicize this by saying, oh, this is, but Swami says, your life is my message.
Yes.
He said, my life is my message, your life is my message. So people are watching you, how you conduct yourself, how you're doing, what you're doing, how do you express all of that? You know, are you egotistical? Are you humble? People watch you. So you don't have to publicize Swami by talking about him, but by being who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So going to the, to answering your question in Arizona State University, all I do is I do my work. Every morning I get up, I tell Swami, Swami, please make me a worthy instrument of you today, Swami. I have a whole story on instrument. One day I asked Swami, not in the physical form, but in a study circle I was participating. That study circle was about being an instrument. So the discussion was happening, as you know, in Canada. You know, we sit all around and then everybody is giving their opinion.
Mm.
So I was just praying to Swami. I said, Swami, whatever you want to speak through me today, Swami, you please speak through me. And then the whole thing about instrument that Swami has talked about in my head, which I shared, was unbelievably profound. So he gave me an example of what an instrument was, right? What a good, being a good instrument was. So I'll picture myself in the morning as being an instrument in Swami's hands. I am the guitar. And I'll say, Swami, the knobs, the six knobs, Swami, please keep my anger in tune today. Please keep my hatred in tune today. Please keep my greed in tune today. Keep my jealousy in tune today. Please keep my ego in tune today, Swami, so that I might serve through your inspiration today in the fullest form. So when I go to work, I tell people, I am excited to go to work. Not one day I feel, oh my God, I got to go to work today. I'm excited. I feel energized. And so I go to work, and for me, work is an expression of Swami's love, an expression of Swami's teachings and what you would want me to do, an expression of his excellence. So it happens. There's no way of explaining it other than I cannot even say I do my very best.
Mm.
I try to do my best knowing that Swami will work through me. And it happens. All of the things that happens, there's nothing like, you know, I did this, therefore that.
So let's say you're sitting in a big meeting where some major decisions have to be made,
yes,
and you have a certain opinion and yes, others have a different opinion, which is different from yours. In your mind, you think you're coming from a place of good intention.
Yes.
And this is better for the larger good, better use of the money or the resources that the university is allocating, and someone else has a different point of view. How do you tackle it?
So, the first thing that you have to understand is everybody comes with good intentions.
Hmm.
The moment you attribute...
Not necessarily. Somebody
might have
an ulterior motive.
No, it could be. But what I'm saying
is... For research funding or something?
For me...
Okay, you have to assume.
Yeah, I have to assume.
But aren't you being naive?
I'm not being naive. So, what I do is, you don't, therefore, not talk about your point of view.
Hmm.
But if you go with the understanding of belittling the other person or somehow their opinion, if you go with the fundamental understanding that somehow they are wrongly and misplaced in their presentation of their point of view, just because you disagree with the point of view does not mean that you have to be disagreeable. There's a big difference, right? You can agree to disagree. You don't have to disagree to disagree, right? And so that happens only when you treat the other person with respect and their point of view with respect. It doesn't matter what they are. That's what Swami would want us to do. I patiently listen to all points of view, and I do exercise my point of view with, you see, my passion and my energy that comes out. The same energy and passion is what I use to communicate my point of view. But I therefore don't expect what that point of view should prevail at the end of the day. Because when you have a group of people giving their points of view, and that is the point of having a team is about people coming with different perspectives. And without attributing motives to perspectives, if you just take them as perspectives, it is like making sambar with multiple spices cooked together. And it will come about to be what it is supposed to be at the end of the day. But you should have never hesitated, never felt that you should not have voiced the opinion. None of that. You give the fullest, your fullest in terms of that. But without feeling, therefore, the outcome has to be exactly what you think the outcome should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do that, I find in most of the circumstances, it works out. Sometimes it may not work out at that point in time, but with time it works out. Things take care of itself. That's why Swami has talked about, you know, patience, perseverance, patience, purity, perseverance, patience. That is, if your motives are pure, if you are willing to persevere, and if you are willing to be patient, I find that most things do work out.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we have a calendar and we have an agenda and we have a point of view that we believe that we should prevail, that we, our point of view should persist. Our point of view is right. When you start taking that kind of an approach, not that I do this all the time, so let me be very clear.
Yeah, okay? But do you ever feel crushed?
I don't feel crushed. I feel disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Crushed is too strong a word.
I see.
You feel disappointed.
I guess you feel crushed when you're a teenager.
Yeah, maybe, exactly. When you're a teenager, you may be crushed. But that's what maturity does for you, and that's what spirituality does for you. You feel disappointed. That's okay. Nobody says that you should not feel disappointed or hurt or anything of that nature, right? That's okay. It's part of the process.
No, but you're supposed to be joyful and happy all the time.
You know, but you learn. You learn to be joyful beyond those emotions.
Right.
It's not that, see, otherwise it's fake emotions in my view. If you're not resolving all of these innate emotions that come out, you're not suppressing them, but you're allowing them to express them, but then you resolve them and you become happy beyond that. Then it is a more permanent way of finding happiness and joy. The moment you start suppressing them, you might find that you have suppressed it, but someday it will come up, its ugly head will come up 10 times more forcefully than otherwise. At least I find that when I suppress things, they don't work. Okay, but when I express them, when I resolve them within myself, where it has got to be resolved, it works out. But in all of these things, whenever I express anything, I do my very best not to hurt the other person. It's hard. I'm not saying these things as simple things. It's very hard. It takes time. And sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't work out. But nobody said that every time you do all of these things and just because you followed all the teachings and you know, you should all work out the way it's supposed to work out. You know, that in itself, I think, is a form of ego in my view, to expect that that's what the outcome should be.
Dr. Pant, you have this uncanny clarity and this enhanced ability to articulate what you believe in and what you practice. And I think that passion and that strength comes from the fact that you actually do bring all that you're talking about into your everyday life, into your thoughts, into your words, into your deeds. So you're so strongly anchored into Swami, yet your journey to Swami did not begin on a very devout note. As a teenager, you were quite a rebellious person, I understand. Yes. That was because of a personal tragedy.
Yes. So here is what happened. So my maternal grandfather, you know, he was a devotee of Swami. He introduced us to Swami as children growing up.
In Madras?
In Madras, but my grandfather lived in Bangalore. So we used to go for summer vacations to his home in Bangalore. And he used to take us one day on a field trip to Whitefield. In the morning, we'll take the passenger train, go to Whitefield, spend the day with Swami, and we'll pack our picnic lunch, and then in the evening, take the train back. So that was my introduction to Swami. But one thing he did every morning, because all of our cousins got together, in order that we don't get into too much trouble, the day would start with 1 hour of bhajans in the morning. He was very disciplined about that. So that's where I learned my bhajans, okay, at a very young age. Then when I was getting to the teenage years, one of my very close cousins who I used to, you know, hang out with in the summer vacations, my first cousin, he suddenly passed away. He was in the first year of engineering college and he passed away. And it was very devastating for me because I prayed to Swami, Swami, you should save him. And when that did not happen, I felt that I had nothing to do with Swami anymore. And I distanced myself from Swami. And then I did my undergraduate degree, first undergraduate degree in physics in the University of Madras before I came to the Indian Institute of Science. And then my grandfather was still in Bangalore. And so I used to go and do bhajans with him in my uncle's place. But I never got this attachment to Swami as I had as a child. So Swami wanted me to find Swami for myself.
I believe your grandfather also wanted you to sing in the Mandali.
Yes, so this was my mother. So I go back, after the Indian Institute of Science, I go to IIT Madras. And so I did my master's there. I was a day scholar. I was staying at home because my home was very close to IIT in Besant Nagar. So my mother was pestering me every day saying that you should go and sing bhajans because the male Mandali bhajans group meets on Wednesday evenings. You should go and sing bhajans. And it was in a Shiva temple. And I was resisting it because first of all, I didn't have the faith in Swami. And secondly, you know, I didn't want to publicly express my bhajan and all that in a public place. Being a teenager, you can imagine that was not what you're looking forward to doing instead of going to the beach. So, therefore, I was resisting this. And one day I asked myself the question, why am I resisting this so much? My mother is asking me all the time, you know, I need to resolve this one way or the other, right? So I had a group of friends who are devotees of Swami. And so when I am with them, I feel like I'm you know, in tune with Swami.
Right.
And then I am with the other group of friends. And then when I see them, I feel like, you know, they are right too. And they will challenge me with, you know, asking me, why can't Swami solve this problem or that problem and so on. So I was tossing back and forth. So I said to myself, I have to put a final, you know, point on this. And therefore I said, I'm going to test Swami. I'm in science, and in science the truth can be tested, isn't it? You take, you know, a pipette or a burette or whatever it is, you mix the acid and the alkali or whatever, the color turns red or blue, and then you know that's what it is. Right? It's very clear. Or the apple falls. No, you don't have to fight with anybody about gravity because the apple fell. So you know what gravity is, isn't it? So I said, I'm going to test Swami. So my grandfather had given a picture of Swami, a small postcard picture of Swami with his hands up like that. So I had the picture with me. So I put the picture up in my bedroom on top of the refrigerator, which was my bedroom. And I didn't tell anybody anything. And I said to Swami, there is only one thing I have as a contract with you. I looked at his face and I said, you know, the only thing, I do not know what God is or who God is. I have no idea. I don't even know what God is, okay? So I said, but the only thing I know is, God is good and good is God. G-O-O-D and G-O-D is inside that. And G-O-D at O, it becomes good. So all I know is that if there is a God, then it's got to be good. So therefore, I am going to be good from tomorrow. I am not going to utter white lies, black lies, blue lies, whatever that might be. Okay? And if there is some person who needs help crossing the road, and lo and behold, the thought that came to me is that if a blind person wants help crossing the road, I will help the blind person cross the road. 25 years later, you see what the connection was. Okay? So, but anyway, so that was the thing I had with him. So I looked at the picture and I said, you know, I'm going to be good from tomorrow. Let me see what you do. It was a challenge. It was not even a request to do, give me this or give me none of that. It was a pure thing of, in a challenge, you know, let's see what you do. So the first day I got up and I looked at the picture and I said, the contract is on. The second day I got up, contract is on. Third day I got up, contract is on. Fourth day when I got up, Vibhuti was flowing from the picture. I was shaken because this was the contract that I had with Swami in the picture.
On the fridge.
One-on-one, on the fridge, one-on-one. I had not told anybody anything. And here, there is somebody who knows what I am thinking, what I am doing. The CIA, the Constant Integrated Awareness, tracking me, right?
Other than the other CIA also. Okay.
Tracking me, knows what's going on.
Right.
And then this manifested. So I said, I have to keep my end of the bargain now.
Right.
So I have to go and attend bhajans right now. Right? So I went to bhajans. And immediately Swami came in my dream. And he said, it is not just enough to attend bhajans. Service to man is service to God. At that point in time, I'm still raw, remember, right? So the first thought that came to me was, I said, well, I give him an inch, he wants a yard now.
Very demanding God.
Yes. That was my initial reaction, right? So I was like, no. Then I said, okay, whatever. You know, if I see somebody needs help, I will serve. Believe it or not, within a week or 10 days, my mother comes to me and says, you know, my Samiti president, she's asking me that they need a person to teach English and math for the slum children. The teacher who used to teach them is gone. And therefore, will you teach the slum children? Because you are, after all, going to IIT, you should know something about English and math. So I agreed to do that because it was a Sunday morning. I said, what? You know, I'll go. And then this dream that Swami came and told me, service to man is service to God. I said, ah, that's interesting. There's a connection now. So I started going to the slum. When I went to the slum, the feeling that I had in me was that I, the guy who's strong in math and English, I'm going to teach his illiterate kids about math and English. That is the attitude in my head. Swami did not send me there to do any service for any children because he could have chosen anybody else. There'd be thousands of other people who would only be too glad to do that. He chose me because he wanted to send me to a workshop to get rid of my problems that I had in my head. So I went there and I found that these children were as bright or not brighter than the children that I had seen. So my preconceived notions, he just tore them down one by one by one, like the onion, you know, peel being peeled like one by one, you know, he's just taking everything out of my
So the my IITN head. Was getting humbled?
Humbled, absolutely humbled, no question about that. And then I saw this amazing set of kids. Anyway, I'm going to jump now. I'll tell you the story another time, hopefully. But let me go to my question. My fundamental question to Swami was, what is God? Who is God? Are you God? These were three questions I had.
What is God? Who is God? And are you
God? Who is God? Are you God? Three questions. Right? And this is my first thing of manifestation was just to show, I know what you're doing. I am watching what you're doing. Right? I know everything. Right? So the connection happened.
Yeah.
Then a set of experiences happened, but I'm going to fast forward and go to this set of experiences that he was very profound. These happened within a matter of couple of months of each other. Okay? So I went to see my sister who was in Canada. She had returned back to Calcutta. So I said, before I take my job after IIT and I graduated, I said, I'll go visit my sister in Calcutta and spend a couple of weeks with her, 2 weeks with her. So I go there and every day in her house, there was a calendar of Swami. Every day Swami used to come in my dream. So the day that I was leaving Calcutta to go to Madras, I asked my sister, is there a book of Swami that I can read? Do you have one? She had brought a trunk of books from Canada, right? And so she went into the trunk and she pulled a book and gave it to me. That was Howard Murfitt's Sai Baba, the Avatar. Right? So I took the book. And so I started reading this book. This is the Howrah Mail. that leaves at 4:30 p.m. those days from Howrah and arrives in Chennai at 5:30 p.m. the next day, 25-hour journey. So I started reading this book at 4:30 p.m. As I'm reading this book, it was a Wednesday, I didn't realize that. Around 6:30, 6:45 p.m., a thought comes in my head. I said, if I was in Chennai, I would have gone to the Samiti to do bhajans from 7 to 8 p.m. I should do bhajans.
In the train.
In the train.
Right.
Then there is this other thought, like the Hindi movies, right? That the good man and the bad man, the villain. Both of them coming in your head and they're talking to each other. That's what is happening in my head. So that this person is saying, you should do bhajans. This person is saying, are you a nutcase? Are you crazy? You're going to do bhajans in the train? Then this person, suddenly profound thought comes. Life is like a train, right? You, all these people that are around you, 25 hours later, you would not ever meet them possibly in your life ever.
And you really need their approval.
Yes. Are you going to worry about them? Or are you going to do what you're supposed to do? So, I'm having this decision to be made. Finally, I decided I am going to do bhajans from 7 to 8.
How old were you then, doctor?
I was 24.
24, okay.
I'm having this discussion in my head, right? So, then I decided I'm going to do bhajans.
Okay.
But I'm not going to disturb anybody. I'm going to do it within myself. So I had this book with a picture of Swami on the book. So I had the book on my lap. And I closed my eyes from 7 to 8. And I did 1 hour of bhajans. As I would have done in the Samiti.
In your head.
In my head. And then at 8 o'clock, the train rolled into Bhuvaneshwar. I had ordered meals in Bhuvaneshwar, which was being loaded. So I left the book on the seat. And I went to the bathroom to wash my hands and my face to come and have my dinner. When I came back, there was a pile of vibhuti on top of the picture of Swami.
Wow.
On the book. So I knew that Swami said, if you give up all of those feelings that you have, that this should be done, that should be done, and give up all your ego, and you do the thing, right thing, then I will manifest and I will bless you. But more importantly, it was about the fact that he knew, the omniscient Swami, knew what I was doing. Like what happened in the picture, right? When I was being good. Again, Swami demonstrated his omniscience through the manifestation of vibhuti that day. Then I continued reading the book. I fell asleep. Early in the morning, in the dream, Swami came to me and said, come and see me in Tirupati. And I said to myself, it cannot be Tirupati because Swami is in Puttaparthi. I must have heard it wrong. And I regurgitated the dream again and again and again. It was very clear, crystal clear, Swami said, come and see me in Tirupati. So I said to myself, maybe Swami is telling me that he is also Lord Venkateshwara. So whenever I go to Tirupati, I will see him. And then I just let it go. And then I continued reading the book. As I was reading the book, about midday, about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, there was this segment in the book about the Rainbow Man. You might have read that.
Yes.
So this person comes, he's a skeptic, and he then looks at Swami, and then he says, the most beautiful thing in nature is a rainbow.
Go let him
and
see
then,
it.
And then he creates a rainbow, right? It comes to him and says, are you happy with the rainbow? And he says, he talks about the vertical rainbow, and he says that there is no sign of a rainbow that could have been created, right? That was the thing. Now, that reading bothered me so much.
Why?
I said, listen, for rainbow, there's got to be a process. There's got to be a moisture. There's got to be water droplets. There's got to be a sunlight that's got to shine through the water droplet. The prism effect has to take place, and there's a science in me. And then the rainbow has to manifest itself. That's the process. I said, I don't care if he's God, but he has to follow the natural law. That was my reaction to this whole thing, right? So then I put the book down and I said, enough of reading for me.
Now you're going psycho.
So I'm just going to put the book down, right? And I said, it doesn't make any sense to me. How can the rainbow be created from thin air? I mean, from nothing, right? That was my reaction. The train is passing through Andhra Pradesh to come to Madras. It was February. It was a very hot day, obviously. And as I'm gazing at the fields and enjoying the green paddy fields, suddenly I look up and there is a huge rainbow in the sky. And I'm just startled and I said, am I imagining this? I just wiped my eyes and I made sure that I'm not dreaming or
there
I'm
is the
hallucinating.
Process. Five-step process is missing.
Hallucinating, right?
No so moisture, no droplets.
Then immediately, that's the first thing I'm doing. I'm wiping my ear. First thing, wiping my eyes to make sure that I'm not dreaming or I'm not imagining. The rainbow is still there. Then I said, then it's got to be, I'm checking for clouds. The first thing. Not a cloud in the sky, a clear blue sky. That frustrated me. Okay? I'm seeing the rainbow, but there's a clear blue sky. Then I put my hand outside the train, and I'm hoping I can sense some moisture. believe me, Karuna, what I was hoping is that somebody will spit water from the train to justify the formation of the rainbow for me. I was that desperate to want the science to back up what was happening in reality. Nothing. And I'm looking at this train passing by for the next 10 minutes. The rainbow is still clear up in the sky.
Dry, arid Andhra Pradesh.
February, as you can see.
Yes.
So he was essentially, you know, getting all my hang-ups addressed. So the next thing, omnipotent form. He said, I will do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do, however I want to do it. So that was the second lesson. Then I went home. I told my mom about this and I forgot about the whole thing. 2 weeks later, one of my friends, my childhood friends, comes to me and says, hey, I'm going to go to Tirupati. Do you want to come with me? So this dream never occurred to me. Sometimes we friends will gather up, we'll go from Chennai to Tirupati, we'll climb the seven hills, we'll leave in the morning, reach in the evening, join the free queues. By midnight, they will let all the people out. So we'll have darshan. In the morning, one of my other friends will do the Anga Pradakshinam and then we'll then come back to Chennai in 24 hours. So I had gone with a group of friends. So I go to Tirupati, we settle down in the cottage, we climb the seven hills, settle down in the cottage, freshen ourselves up, and then I'm going to join the free queues. As I'm walking, I'm passing the Sanctum Sanctorum to join the free queues. Just the side of that. As I'm passing the Sanctum Sanctorum, I see in the opposite direction a person with Swami's hair, exactly Swami's hair, a white dhoti, a white shirt with betel nut leaves, kind of a thing, red lips, bright face, walking towards me with another person, walking towards me like this. And I said, what is this? I have never seen this hairdo other than Swami before or after. This Afro hairdo, which is a very specific type, right? So I'm sort of blown away. I'm looking at this. And this person is crossing. And then they're going behind me now. So I turn around and I'm looking at the back of the hair to make sure that all is the same. As I'm checking this, I have stopped and my friends have gone forward walking. So one of my friends turned around and said, hey, Pancha, where are you? So I just immediately ran to join them and I looked back. This person had vanished.
By vanished, you mean dematerialized?
Not there anymore. I mean, you would have expected they would have walked a few more steps.
Gone.
They're not there.
I see.
And then it occurred to me, oh my God, Swami told me, come and see me in Tirupati. The omnipresent form is a third step within the few weeks. And then I said, I asked Swami, what is God? He said, God is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. That's what God is. What is God? Who is God? A person who is able to express the omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence is God. Are you God? The answer to that is very clear. So I was a naive, I wouldn't even call me innocent, but naive person challenging Swami and asking him a question. And he was generous and gracious enough to give me the experiences within a very short time to reveal what God is. And then many years later, Karuna, I was in Prashanthinilayam. And so they had asked if I will address the girl students from Anantapur. They were here. So whenever they ask me to talk about Swami, I'll close my eyes and I'll tell Swami, Swami, whatever you want to say through me tomorrow, please inspire me and motivate me and speak through me. Immediately as I prayed, Swami said, start with three ohms. I said, okay, Swami. And then narrate your experiences about three ohms. He said, you know what three ohms is? I said, no, Swami. He said, three ohms is invoking God. And the three aspects of God are omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. That's what the three ohms stand for.
My God, I've never heard of that before. What a nice interpretation.
That's what he said to me.
And again, we've been parroting those words.
Yes. So
thoughtlessly.
He said, when you say om, you're invoking God as through the omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipotence forms of God. That's what you're invoking because that's what God is. That's what he told me. And that's what I shared in that talk, and subsequently I shared that as an experience in other talks.
I just want to ask you something. You know, when you were selected to this highly prestigious, the National Science Board by President Obama, I'm sure the process, because there must be a very stringent screening process involved. And your Psi credentials, you wear them very boldly and confidently and openly. Was there any impact?
Nothing. So basically, I am who I am. I'm an open book. So they do a complete background check. And I'm very scientific. I believe in science 100%, right? And there is no question about that. And I believe in the scientific exploration, which is very important for the betterment of humankind. And
as also in spiritual exploration.
Absolutely. They're not odds with one another.
Exactly.
They're not odds with. They're different facets of the same truth. Mm-hmm. Right? So we realize truth through many means, through science, through spirituality, through work, through whatever tool you may want to use. It's still a form of how do you realize truth. And science is absolutely truth. It's nothing but truth.
Your faith has never acted as an impediment to your progress.
It's in fact reinforced.
As a professional scientist.
As a professional scientist, reinforced. The magnificence of science, the ultimate scientific truth, is only enriched by having this perspective. Right? I don't see that at odds with one another at all. I don't see why people feel that they are at odds with one another. They are not at odds with one another. If you want to think of them as odds with one another, that is one point of view. But my point of view is they are enriching each other. They're reinforcing each other rather than contradicting anything at all in my view.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to sit with President Obama and talk about all this?
We don't get to sit with the president and talk about these scientific things because the board essentially meets and then we discuss scientific progress. But we attend events where President Obama is present. And mm-hmm. So, you know, he's a amazing, amazing president. We are very proud of President Obama. I mean, he's done amazing things for the country and he has done amazing things for the scientific community. And we are very proud of that. Very proud of that. And it's really an honor to serve. See, when the president calls, it doesn't matter who the president is. When the president calls for you to do something, every citizen of the country feels privileged and honored to be able to serve the country. So it's about serving the country. So you feel it's a privilege, it's an honor, and to me it's also a great blessing.
And what do you have to say about serving the president of all the universes?
That's truly an honor which is beyond belief. It's just, I mean, there's no words to express that. The words are very confining, you see. And so I'm very grateful. Swami will always say, you know, thanks.
Because you're a president of the Satyasai organization of Region 9.
So I'm grateful to Swami for giving me the opportunities that he's given me and giving me. And I'm hopeful that I'm able to, you know, do things that he would want done through me. And that he'll be happy. That's the only thing that I really want is that he feels happy that I am doing the things that he would want seen done through this instrument, as he works with all the other instruments, the millions and millions of instruments that he has.
Because
all
he's the only approval worth seeking, really.
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing more that you can ask for. Mm. And I'm very privileged to have that opportunity to know him, to have heard about him, to have seen him, to have interacted with him, and most importantly, to be inspired by him every day.
Wow. That's wonderful to hear from you, Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan of the Arizona State University and also the regional president of the Satyasai International Organizations Region 9, which comprises of the states of Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. I know that we have barely scratched the surface, and dear listeners, I assure you that we will not let go of Dr. Panch so easily. So he's leaving today, but when he's back in about 6 months' time, we will record a series of conversations with him to catch up with all the wonderful experiences he has with Swami, especially the learning he has had through his direct interactions and how he has translated that into the person that he is. But today was just the curtain raiser, and for that I thank you deeply, sir.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is mine, and I'm grateful to you, Karuna, for engaging me. It's truly an honor to serve Swami.
It is truly for all of us and for me to just learn so much from you. Thank you, and Sai Ram, sir.
Jai Sai Ram.
Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, you just heard a conversation with Dr. Sethuraman Panchanathan. In conversation with him was Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi, and this interview was recorded on 31st December 2016. This came to you as part of our radio program, Tryst with Divinity, a series of conversations with individuals whose lives have been touched and transformed by the love of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listeners, we hope you like this program. As always, you can send us your feedback by writing to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and loving Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam.
So सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो
सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु